Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. And as this year comes to a close, we will look back on some of the stories that dominated the news in 2013. Today, we'll focus on the growing income inequality in America that may well become a theme in the 2014 election, assuming the Democrats find the courage of their convictions to broach a subject all too many of our fellow citizens are painfully aware of. We'll begin with a broadcast of Background Briefing from March 27, 2013, and speak with Michael Lind, the author of Land of Promise, an economic history of the United States, on the real nature of American capitalism that is no longer about creating wealth, but extracting it in a new form of rentier capitalism that rewards the real takers as opposed to the industrial capitalists of old who were the makers. Michael Lind offered his arguments in a series of articles at Salon.com, Private Sector Parasites, How Rich Mooches Hurt America, and Defeating Useless Rich People. Then from July 28, 2013, we speak with Tom Herschel, a professor of sociology at Cornell University and director of the Population and Development Program. We discuss the new report that he worked on for the Associated Press that finds 4 out of 5 U.S. adults struggling with joblessness and near poverty in an economy in which President Obama says the income gap is fraying America's social fabric. Then, from September 1, 2013, in contrast to the flat or falling wages for working Americans, we look into the scandal of CEO pay and how corporate heads who either preside over massive failures and losses, are engaged in fraud and deception, or are bailed out by the taxpayers, the bailed out, the booted, or the busted, are rewarded. Veteran labor journalist Sam Pizzagatti joins us to discuss the new report released by the Institute for Policy Studies. He co-authored the 20th Anniversary Executive Excess Report that examines the performance of 241 corporate chief executives. Joining us now is Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. His books include The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, The American Way of Strategy, and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. And Michael Lind has a 3-part series of articles at Salon.com, Private Sector Parasites, How Rich Mooches Hurt America, and Defeating Useless Rich People. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
And your articles at Salon.com, of course, they have very provocative titles, but it would seem to me that the American people need to wake up to the reality of what American capitalism has become. You describe it as a kind of rentier capitalism. So explain the difference between rents and profits.
Well, economists used to distinguish between rents, which are extracted from society by people who control valuable resources, which could be natural resources, it could be creditors with privileged rights to create money, and profits, which are earned by businesses, you know, by selling goods and services that people want. So if you are the owner of a toll bridge and every time someone passes, you have to pay a toll, and you're just earning this money for no effort whatsoever, it's completely passive activity, then you're a classic of rentier or rentier, as they say in France. If you are in the business of, let's say, making new tablets and selling them to people who want this new appliance, and your income comes from the results of this innovation, then you're a classic capitalist. What I argue in my Salon series is that a lot of economists and many conservatives and libertarians have forgotten the distinction between rentiers, these purely passive money extractors, and actual entrepreneurs and business executives, and the business workers, too. Who are adding something to society. And I go beyond that and argue that to really understand the economy, there are indeed takers and makers. There are productive people and unproductive people. But the takers are not all in the private sector, or all in the public sector, and the makers are not all in the private sector. You can't have a flourishing modern industrial economy without a good school system, without an infrastructure system, without good governance. So that's an essential part of the productive economy in the public sector. At the same time, all private money-making activities are not productive. They don't necessarily add to the long-term capability of the economy to produce goods and services using technology at a lower price.
Well, I thought, for example, the toll booth owner was the person who built the road and therefore was entitled to pay for it through tolls. But, I mean, aren't there better examples like hedge fund managers who basically handle the money of wealthy people and essentially make money for themselves and make money for wealthy people?
Well, and also there's the other distinction that needs to be made besides that between rents and profits is between real serious investments in productive enterprises and speculation in assets. So if I'm rich and I invest in a breakthrough new technology that transforms the world for the better, you know, that's what capitalism does well. If I use the same amount of money and invest it because I want to corner the world market for Picasso paintings and then sell them at a premium, that has done nothing, you know, to increase the productivity of the actual economy of goods and services. It's just pure speculation.
And nothing's more, I think, a more graphic example of pure speculation is these microsecond trades that go on and these high-speed computer trades that go on Wall Street, which a lot of the hedge funds are behind, where they just literally churn over billions of stocks for milliseconds and make tiny fractions of profits, but it all adds up.
Yeah, they're leveraging currencies or, in some cases, imperfections in the stock market that ordinary investors can't detect, and it really serves no useful function in terms of long-term, patient, steady investment in productivity-enhancing enterprises, which is why a lot of economists, including the late James Tobin of Yale, have proposed taxing it as just a form of unproductive gambling. He proposed a Tobin tax, a small financial transactions tax that could generate a lot of money for governments. At the same time, it's a kind of a sin tax. And sin taxes actually are so-called sin taxes are the traditional response of governments to unproductive activities. You're not going to outlaw them. At least you can tax them and raise revenue from them. What a lot of governments do as well is to prevent the rentiers from making excessive amounts of money at the expense of the rest of the economy is to have very high taxes on rents, in some cases property taxes. A lot of countries, including Australia and Canada, have super profits taxes or resource taxes on natural resources on the theory that the mere fact that there's a rare earth mine on your property, really you've done nothing to justify having a vast fortune as a result of that compared to a real entrepreneur. It's just an accident of land title. And in the case of Canada, the taxes from the resource extraction in some cases are redistributed among all the provinces on the theory that it's unfair that a single province or state should have the benefits of this geographic accident.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and author of Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States. And he has a three-part series of articles at Salon.com, Private Sector Parasites, How Rich Mooches Hurt America, and Defeating Useless Rich People. So obviously it's become culturally acceptable. The new definition of capitalist, as you point out in your article, it's not about the productive entrepreneur or the successful industrialist, but anybody who makes money nowadays. And this has led to these people like these payday lenders and this for-profit college racket. In both of those cases, it's the federal government that allows these parasites to make money because they make campaigns to politicians. And it really gets down to our campaign finance system where they can simply bribe enough congresspeople to steal people blind. In the case of the education racket with these for-profit colleges, that's all federal money that they're making money on.
Well, that's right. And if you look at federal, state, and local levels, the traditional argument for having public education, including public universities and colleges, was that this was kind of a natural monopoly or oligopoly, and just like sewage and water and electricity. And you wanted to provide it to your citizens at cost without needing to pay shareholders super profits or you know, enormous bonuses and benefits to the managers. What we see now with this trend towards privatization and the replacement of social insurance with private for-profit plans, you know, like Paul Ryan's plan for voucherizing Medicare, that's the worst of all worlds, because you would pressure, or in some cases through individual mandates, compel people to buy these private substitutes for former public programs. But at the same time, these would be profit-making enterprises. And so you would have forcing your citizens to pay for the salaries and the compensation of very well-remunerated executives and shareholders.
Well, this is, I think, again, because of the power of money, and because we have a political campaign system based upon money. So he who has the most money controls the most politics in this country. And so that's led to the oligarchs essentially taking over and writing laws, and they have their faithful servants in the Congress. And they've created a system for themselves where they privatize their gains while they socialize their losses.
Well, I think progressives really need to make this distinction as well, because what I'm arguing is not simply the usual line that there are special interests exploiting the public. There are good special interests and bad special interests. Now, it may very well be that farmers and miners and manufacturers rig laws in their favor to have, you know, good depreciation allowances or a subsidy here or there. But if at the end of the day, they are creating a more productive economy and everybody's benefiting from it, you know, you can forgive a certain amount of subsidy. If it's a purely wasteful activity, like replacing Social Security with for-profit annuities and forcing hundreds of millions of seniors just to pay management fees to money managers on Wall Street, then, you know, there's no benefit to the economy from that at all. It's a net loss. Except to the individuals who profit from this what's called rent-seeking activity. So the point is not that that government is good or business is bad or vice versa, that there are rent-extracting elements in both the private and the public sector, just as there are productive elements on both sides.
So, Michael Lind, obviously, to redefine or at least define our current form of capitalism accurately and make the distinction between finance capitalism, rentier capitalism, and industrial capitalism, which is what we used to have and what we still think of in large part, even right. though the extractive types have basically taken over, and Wall Street is, of course, the poster boy of extractive capitalism, and Mitt Romney was the poster boy of their perfect representative. So at least we can breathe a sigh of relief that he didn't become president. But what can be done then, apart from the first stage, meaning the wake-up call, which is what your articles at Salon.com are providing? But you're basically saying this: it's going to require a populist campaign, right, to force this unproductive form of capitalism to basically take away its privileges.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, maybe it would need a coalition of progressives and some Main Street conservatives, and it would cut across party lines to some extent. I got pushback by including higher education in the rent-extracting unproductive sector, because a lot of progressives have very idealized utopian view of the higher education system. In fact, it's become arguably parasitic. That's not to say there aren't good professors and great schools. But if you look at the last generation, the costs have just exploded way out of proportion to increases in economic growth. The tuition has exploded. 50% of undergraduates now are taught by non-tenured lecturers and adjuncts who make slightly above poverty level wages. You know, some of them make $14,000, $15,000, $16,000 a year. So that system is clearly broken. The medical system in the United States, in addition to the actual valuable medical services that are provided, there's also just pure extraction by monopolistic pharma companies, by, frankly, a lot of overpaid specialty physicians, not so much the general practitioners, and by hospitals. And we just know this to be the case, because if you compare the U.S. to very similar societies, including Canada and Western Europe, the same things, the same items, like aspirin and doctor's visits and hospitals and appendectomies, cost twice as much in the U.S.
Or much more, actually.
Or more than twice as much, yeah. So that's just pure waste. And usually the argument for making the economy more efficient takes the form of conservative arguments for attacking middle-class entitlements and slashing wages and destroying unions. I think you can have a progressive or even progressive-slash-centrist efficiency agenda where you squeeze out a lot of the private sector waste. And, well, and of course, you should go after public sector waste, you know, in the Defense Department, for example, where it exists at the same time.
Well, Michael Linda, I was going to suggest that the place to start maybe in terms of creating a kind of populist movement here to essentially get rid of this parasitic form of capitalism that's dominating our economy, that the millennial generation might be the place to start. Student loan debt now has passed $1 trillion mark, second only to household mortgage debt. And these kids are getting ripped off by, you say, as you mentioned, by the public sector and private or universities, as well as, of course, the government-subsidized for-profits, which are outright rackets, where they indenture them for life and give them worthless diplomas.
The poster boy for a rent-extracting parasitic industry is the student loan industry, which got Congress – this was unbelievable when I just learned this recently. But in the last decade, they persuaded Congress to write laws so that student loans cannot be discharged in bankruptcy.
Right.
The whole point of bankruptcy is to free people from debts that they cannot pay.
Right, but if you have this generation that's getting ripped off and indentured and there are no jobs for them, that's a good place to start, isn't it, with mobilizing a movement?
I think so, and I think that the millennial generation, it really hasn't found any leaders. There's a time lag. Even Obama really reflects more the worldview of the 1990s Clinton neoliberals in many ways, rather than the younger generation. The older generation of neoliberals in the 90s and the early 2000s had this you know, win-win view of the future. We were all going to be well-paid knowledge workers, you know, inventing things, and other countries could make things, and you know, you could work on Wall Street, or you could you know, maybe write software programs or something like that.
Right, the great information highway that Al Gore was beckoning us to.
Yeah, and so in the actual real world of the United States, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the majority of jobs being created now are essentially jobs that require only on-the-job training beyond high school, and they tend to be low-paid service jobs, healthcare aides, fast food preparers, and others. If you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics site where they talk about jobs of tomorrow, apart from registered nurses and teachers, there are no college-educated professional jobs being created in the list of the most numerous jobs at all. And so, you know, I think to that kind of progressivism, this sort of feel-good, happy-talk progressivism where everyone's going to go to college and then, you know, get this very well-paying professional job, that's been discredited by events just as much as the right-wing ownership society in which the janitors, you know, don't need higher wages because they're just going to be counting their returns from their stock market investments.
So just in closing, Michael Lind, what do you think are the chances of a real dialogue, because you're trying to start a debate here with your articles at Salon.com, amongst the economists and the policymakers and the pundits? Do you have any sense that people are really interested in really looking deeper at the very nature of our capitalism? I mean, we've got...
Well, I think so. The response to this particular series of articles in Salon was very encouraging. I got more response to that than anything I'd written in a long time. And I'm not the only one who's talking about this. If you look at writers like Mike Konzol and various others, the economist Michael Hudson, there's even this term rentier, which is kind of an obscure, antiquated term that most people don't understand, somebody who just lives on rents or passive investment. This is gradually bubbling up in discourse. Now, there's a time lag. It sort of works. It begins in the intellectual community, and then filters into journalism, and then into broader public discussion. But I think that there's certainly an audience waiting for a story of what has gone on with the economy, other than the New Democrat story that we just need to deregulate everything and send more people to universities. And the right stories, which is just that we should privatize entitlements and cut taxes on the rich. I don't think either of those are going to win a cent, particularly from this younger generation you're talking about.
Well, Michael Lind, I thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. His books include The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, The American Way of Strategy, and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. And Michael Lind has a three-part series of articles at Salon.com, Private Sector Parasites, How Rich Moochers Hurt America, and Defeating Useless Rich People. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll return with a broadcast from July the 28th on how 4 out of 5 U.S. adults struggle with joblessness and near poverty. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Herschel, who is the director of the Population and Development Program and a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. He's just published or co-authored a new report at the Associated Press on the widening gap of wealth inequality in the United States, where 4 out of 5 adults are struggling with joblessness and near poverty. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Herschel.
Thanks for inviting me in.
And the new study that you have been in, one of the co-authors of, there are other authors as well. A lot of research has clearly gone into this, but it does really explode the kind of idea that we've had about how American poverty has been gauged in previous sort of official reports, if you will. So tell us about the methodology here and why all of a sudden your report is indicating that everything we thought about this country is wrong, that we've had an extremely exaggerated and glossy idea about the American dream and the lives of the majority of our citizens. Things are, according to your report, a lot worse than they have been portrayed.
Well, what we did, Ian, was we decided we wanted to put time into our analysis. And so we found a data set on 5,000 families that was maintained for 42 years. And so we observed these 5,000 families as they changed over time, had children, the children stayed in the study. And what we found was that when you track people over time like this, you get a very different impression of what their lives are like. Official data from the Census Bureau, now this is a study that's housed at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. It's a very, very, very well-done data set, very, very good methodology. But when you look over time, you see that it's typical for Americans to encounter at least one year where the family head is unemployed, or where people are in poverty, or where they're relying on a social safety net to get by. And that's surprising because this is not part of the social discourse that we have in the country, where 4 out of 5 Americans are experiencing serious hard times, at least. And, of course, many people get it for more than one year. And so, you know, our study kind of encapsulates those kind of statistics.
So the bottom line here is that poverty is not about them, it's about us.
That's correct, that's correct. Poverty is really something that's being driven, I think, by our market society, that, people are maybe doing really well for a few years, Things are going well, and then suddenly somebody loses a job or somebody falls off a roof or something happens where someone goes in the hospital in the family, and then people tumble and they have these one or more years of hard times. And I think that as we see the dynamics of the market economy intensifying in the context of, you know, the global crisis, of the financial crisis, and all the things that are going on in the world right now, we really see a need not just for politicians to fix things with policy, but for some kind of new economic system. And I think that economic system really needs to be demanded by the people that are not doing so well. And those are the people that are not really part of the discourse. A lot of the discourse is about people at the top, the celebrities, people making lots of money. That's really what dominates American culture.
But what you've found out in your new study for the Associated Press, Thomas Herschel, is that economic insecurity amongst whites is more pervasive than is shown in the government's poverty data, and it affects more than 76% of white adults by the time they turn 60. Now, what I find extraordinary about that is that, of course, that President Obama has a problem with poor white people in this country, and many don't see themselves as being poor and white. In November, Obama won the votes of just 36% of what's called non-college whites, which is the worst performance since Ronald Reagan's landslide victory over Walter Mondale. This seems to me to be really an interesting irony, isn't it, that the president, who just made an impassioned speech this week saying that he's going to dedicate the rest of his term in office to making America work again for working Americans, and that the people in this country that most dislike this president are the ones that are being most affected by poverty and joblessness, even if they don't recognize it.
That is quite an irony, Ian. I think part of that is just what we could call the politics of race, the fact that the president is black, and that there's, especially in the southern region of the United States, we see a lot of manipulation of voting districts and a kind of politics where race and class and sometimes even religion is thrown in. People get divided along certain lines socially, and they're not able to maybe really see the broader picture of what's happening in the country. And I think there's a history of this that goes back, well, you know, to the beginning of the country, and it really hasn't ended. And I think, in effect, the Supreme Court is really kind of ramping that up with its discrediting of the enforcement procedures of the Voting Rights Act, that this makes that even more likely to happen, this kind of people seeing the country through a racial lens rather than through the lens of their own experience. And I think it's a very serious situation.
And, of course, the Trayvon Martin verdict brought that into light and have inflamed that divide. And, of course, obviously, it's the idea that somebody got away with murder is very disturbing for a lot of people. Now,
It's very disturbing, especially murder of a child. I mean, that, to me, that's about the worst thing I can imagine.
Right. So you know, we have there's the economy, and then there's the society, and the president himself, in an interview in Sunday's New York Times, is concerned that the income gap is fraying the U.S. social fabric. He made allusions to racial tensions, etc., in his interview with the New York Times. So they're inextricably bound. In many ways, it would seem that what your report is showing, Thomas Herschel, is that they are a distraction from the economic realities, and that if everybody in this country who's economically disadvantaged woke up and recognized the reality, then they may get politically active in a constructive way. But where is that catalyst going to come from? Are they going to listen to a black president?
Well, I think it's maybe a black president. I think really there needs to be some kind of alternative political party. I think both the Democrat and the Republican Party tend to be more influenced by kind of the winners of the economic game. And I feel like even though Obama is a black president, he's very much, and his rhetoric tends to focus on what he calls the middle class rather than looking at the fact that, you know, our study shows 4 out of 5 they may be members of the middle class part of the time, but they're actually not doing well. They're not members of the middle class for great parts of their lives. So I think that a new kind of discussion needs to happen in the country that really is based on the reality of people's experience and more common things that people have.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Herschel, who's the director of the Population and Development Program and a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. He just co-authored a new report at the Associated Press on the widening gap of wealth inequality in the United States, where 4 out of 5 adults are struggling with joblessness and near poverty. And in your study, you have the index of economic insecurity. I just mentioned that's engulfing 76% of white adults by the time they're 60. And the gauge defines economic insecurity as a year or more of periodic joblessness, reliance on government aid, such as food stamps, etc., and an income below 150% of the poverty line measured across all races. And if you do that, the risk of economic insecurity rises to 79%. So this is a stunning statistic. And I guess the reason that we don't recognize the reality of poverty and how pervasive it is with working Americans, I think it's a better term than certainly the present middle class Americans, is that starting with Reagan, incomes have not gone up. They've been flat since the Carter administration, and that what the establishment, for the want of a better description, have done, starting under Reagan and accelerating with Alan Greenspan, was that they made credit incredibly available for working Americans to give them the illusion that their standard of living, while their wages were flat, to give them the illusion that their standard of living was raising, making credit available where the banks get their money for what, less than 1% from the Fed, and they charge it back at 18.5%. And then you've got the Walmart factor, where all this cheap stuff from China is, you can go and buy that. So you feel like you're still in the middle class by being able to shop on borrowed money, right? Is that what's kept the illusion?
There's definitely a game that's being played. I think it actually goes back to the early 1970s. Our study begins in 1968, and we've kind of captured this period. And this period of time has been a period of actually the top end of the income distribution has been monopolizing a greater share of the total income through rising affluence. And so you have a lot of people. It was actually rather uncommon for people to make more than $200,000 a year when our study started. That's been going up quite steadily. So you have a group of about 10 to 20% of the country that's experiencing rising wealth and income, and then the bottom 70 to 80% are experiencing, or they're stagnating, as you suggested, which is the majority. And I think that you're right that people are able to borrow and to get their kids to college on borrowed money, to borrow to pay for to use their house as a kind of an ATM, that there are schemes going on, but those things are wearing thin now. And I think we're starting to reach a position where people are not going to be able to go forward as easily as before. This has been going on for, 30, 40 years. So I think we're kind of coming to a day of reckoning when the people at the bottom need to have the rules of the game need to be changed. And I think it's difficult for politicians to really make that happen, given the way the politics is conducted in the country right now. And so I think some new kind of, something like the Green Party or some alternative political formation needs to begin to start to have a voice in the discourse so that people can start to address situations from where they're at rather than from where they're projected in the public discourse as it's constituted right now.
And just adding insult to injury, you have the new phenomenon of student debt. So the young kids getting an education, pay for it on loans, which they have to pay back, and now the interest rates doubled on federal loans. And they get more and more indentured, as there are less and less job prospects emerge. And if you just watch what's just happened in with the bankruptcy of the city of Detroit, you recognize that the notion of a social contract in this country is absolutely, you know, compared to the social democracies in Europe and Australia and elsewhere, is just shocking. It's never really had been there. But now what's left of it is being eviscerated, and the pensioners and the public employees in Detroit are going to lose their pensions. Meanwhile, the city of Detroit is fully funding a $400 million arena for the Detroit Red Wings. So
yeah, for hockey.
There you have the priorities of government today to take care of the people who take care of the politicians. I mean, I guess at the heart of it.
That's exactly it. That's it. You nailed it, Ian. I really think that's an important point. And I think the problem is that the people, the 4 out of 5 Americans that are experiencing hardship, they don't really have an organized voice that's in the discourse. And I think people need to think about things before they act. And we can't think about things until we can talk them over and write about them, you know, put them on blogs. I mean, there appears to be lots of freedom on the Internet to say these things, but I think actually discourse is relatively constrained by the more privileged elements of society. And so it's very, very difficult to do this, and I think we need voice to change the direction of the country and somehow. I mean, I think we have a situation where we have, you know, a robot can make a car, but a robot can't buy a car. I mean, that's really, I think, a good problem to have. We just need to get the robots working in the public interest and have some kind of society that produces for everyone, not just for the 5-10% that are benefiting.
So how can our audience get hold of this new study that you and your colleagues have done for the Associated Press?
Well, our study is being published as a book next year by Oxford University Press. We did the work the last year or so, and it's coming out as a book with Professor Mark Rank and myself. And so that will be available commercially next year. The study is kind of an advanced look at some of our findings in the study, where we look at not just the poverty, but also the wealth of America. And we also really talk to people a lot. We do a lot of interviews to really try to understand how people are processing their experience, because I think that's really important. It's not just about numbers. It's also about what people think and what they're feeling, and trying to gauge that and get a sense of how to move forward.
But what's happening in America is that the racial and class divides are being stirred up, arguably by the same establishment that's stealing the country blind. Meanwhile, the people, the 80% who are getting shafted, are being distracted by this and not getting together and forming a more perfect union to participate in the American dream that was promised to them.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. That's why our title is about chasing the dream, because I don't think that we've really caught up with it yet. I think we're still chasing it, and I think that we can catch it because we are the majority right now. We're 4 out of 5, and I think that it's within our grasp, but we have to, so we need to begin communicating in new ways and to begin organizing in new ways to turn the country around, I guess.
So if people can't get your book now, what are the, I guess they can, this is at the Associated Press, this digest of the study, right?
That's right. There is a report which has some of the numbers from one of our chapters at the Associated Press.
Okay. Well, I thank you for joining us. I mean, I think this is some of the most important things. And of course, we know that there's a huge battle over the debt ceiling that's going to be coming up. We'll visit that again. And
right,
you know, and of course, the president has now finally given up on talking about this complete distraction known as the deficit, and which has always been a ruse to cut taxes on the rich. Now,
exactly.
Now at least he's starting to talk about the real economy, the one that you've talked about with 80% of Americans,
right.
4 or 5 living in poverty. Well, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Herschel, the director of the Population Development Program and a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. He has just authored a new report at the Associated Press on the widening gap of wealth inequality in the United States, where 4 out of 5 adults are struggling with joblessness and near poverty. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with a broadcast from September the 1st, 2013, about the scandal of CEO pay in America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now on this Labor Day weekend is Sam Pizzagatti, who is a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He is an editor at the online newsletter Too Much, and he's the author of a new report released Wednesday by the Institute for Policy Studies, the 20th Anniversary Executive Excess Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Pizzagatti.
Thank you.
And the annual, and this is the 20th annual anniversary executive excess report, which came out this Wednesday, lists the CEOs of, in the United States, 241 corporate chief executives who've ranked among America's 25 highest paid CEOs for one or more of the past 20 years. And the categories are, and shall we go through the categories, or just in general, tell me why you feel that necessary, particularly when we're focusing on Labor Day weekend about the state of American labor, why are we talking about the CEOs? I think I know the answer, which is that they're outrageously paid compared to the workers.
Yes, and they've gotten outrageously paid by implementing policies that have hurt workers. They've gotten fantastically rich by downsizing, by outsourcing, by turning full-time jobs into part-time jobs, by rolling back pension and other benefits, by freezing wages, by refusing to pay decent wages in the first place. And they've taken all these actions because all these actions fatten the corporate bottom line, and their compensation is based on that bottom line. So there's a really good reason to talk about CEO compensation on Labor Day.
And now, in terms of the 40% of the top performing CEOs that were either bailed out, booted out, or busted, let's deal with the booted out. My understanding is that in spite of their poor performances, the CEOs who were booted out, their golden parachutes are valued at an average of $48 million? Is that?
Yes. Yes. They've these booted out CEOs occupied 14% of the 500 slots on our list, and they did walk away with average golden parachutes of $47.7 million. That's quite a bit for people who've been fired from their jobs.
And in terms of the busted, they're the ones that ended up, you know, charged and fined and had to settle for breaking the law. Give us some examples there, because I understand, you know, that even bigger payments have been shelled out for some of these people.
Yes, we looked at 19 of CEOs in this category. 18 of their corporations shelled out over $100 million each in fines or penalties. Yet these CEOs were made out like bandits. So, for instance, former Bristol-Myers Squibb CEO Charles Heinbold, who later became George Bush's ambassador to Sweden, he received $450 million and never returned any of his compensation. His company paid $450 million in fines, and Heinbold never returned any of the compensation that he received.
And what did he get fined for?
He got fined for accounting fraud. Bristol Myers was found liable for all sorts of accounting frauds. In other words, under his leadership, Bristol Squibb cooked the books, and that's a very common phenomenon that we've seen in corporate America.
Well, of course, we have the example of the governor of Florida, who I think didn't he pay the biggest fine in corporate America, $1.7 billion for fraud, defrauding the government and defrauding Medicare.
Yes, he used to run one of the biggest private profit-making hospital chains in the United States,
and he's
which paid an enormous penalty.
And he was rewarded by the voters in Florida, and they made him governor.
That's right. After he shelled out a ton for a massive advertising campaign that whitewashed his image.
Right. So let's move on through your list here, Sam Pizzagatti, of the 20th Anniversary Executive Excess Report to the Men's Club, which, of course, indicates how few women are in corporate America. There was an interesting study recently indicating that a majority of households now, I'm not sure it's a majority, I think maybe it's up to 40% to 50, close to 50%. Of the households in the United States are now headed by a woman who's the primary breadwinner. So that's what's happening in the level of working Americans in the middle class. But at the top, the glass ceiling is well intact, is it not?
That's right. The CEO, the highly paid CEO club, is almost all male. In fact, only four women over the past 20 years have appeared in one of the annual lists of the most highly paid top 25 CEOs, only four over those 20 years. So what we're talking about here when we talk about the most highly paid CEOs is most definitely a purely men's club.
And the four women, how they're doing? I mean, is there...
Well, they're taking off after the men on the list. They're no great shakes in terms of what they're doing for working people in the United States. So, for instance, Carol Bartz over at Yahoo, during her short tenure there, she slashed 4% of the tech firm's workforce. In 2009, her first year on the job, she walked off with $45 million in compensation. She ended up getting fired 2 years later.
Where do you get jobs like that, Sam?
Well, you get them all the time in the chief executive suites of corporate America.
I see. So let's then talk about the billion-dollar club.
Yes. There are several CEOs who have made in their annual CEO compensation who have made over $1 billion over the past 20 years. Some of those names, well, actually all three of the names are quite familiar. Larry Ellison, who's the CEO at Oracle, who's now the corporate mover and shaker behind the America's Cup yacht races going on in San Francisco. Sanford Weill, the former Citigroup CEO, and of course Michael Eisner, the Disney CEO. All of them have made over $1 billion just in annual compensation.
And of course, in terms of Larry Ellison, that's small change, right?
That's small change. He's now, depending on the list, the third or fourth most wealthy billionaire in the world.
So, Sam Pizzagatti, let's then move on the 20th Anniversary Executive Excess Report list. Let's go to the next category, the Taxpayer Trough Club.
Yes. Well, I think this piece of it may be the most galling piece of all, that a number of the CEOs that we looked at on our 20 years worth of most highly paid CEO list, a number of the CEOs get their money by doing business with the government. Now, Americans really get upset when elected officials are getting rich at our expense. But we have these corporate CEOs who are getting far, far richer at our expense. The CEOs of defense contractors like Lockheed Martin, United Technologies, IBM, General Electric, Honeywell. These companies are rewarding their CEOs at incredibly high levels and have been doing this over the past 20 years. 12% of the 500 slots that we looked over the last 20 years are occupied by CEOs who essentially depend on tax dollars for all the business or the major portion of the business their companies do.
So they have socialized losses and capitalist gains, right? And they have the best of both worlds. They have cost-plus socialism, so they get guaranteed bottom line covered, and then the government pays them a guaranteed profit.
That's right. So we look at a company like Lockheed Martin, 82% of the revenues that Lockheed Martin now takes in on an annual basis come from the federal government, and a huge proportion of what's left come from state governments and other governmental bodies. Over the past 20 years, five times Lockheed Martin has had its CEO on the top 25 list, the annual top 25 list.
So have you looked into this new phenomenon where this other raid on the Treasury, because the military-industrial complex has been raiding the Treasuries for decades throughout the Cold War, and more recently the contractor wing of the – or an adjunct to the military-industrial complex, the contractors, they've been raising the Treasury, and now you have – on top of that, you have the terrorism-industrial complex that came after 9/11. They've been also raiding the Treasury. And now, following the Edward Snowden revelations, you also have the intelligence industrial complex. 70% of intelligence has now been privatized. So all of those, they're bad enough. But there's a new phenomenon that I've been covering lately, Sam Pizzagatti, and that is these for-profit colleges that are a complete rip-off. And even just a few days ago, the president, in a Q&A in Scranton, Pennsylvania, when he was out touting his program to lower college costs, was asked a question about these colleges, and he had acknowledged that there's some really bad actors there. But they get all of their money from the taxpayer. They get these young students, minority kids, vets. They get federal dollars, and they charge these loans back to these kids for exorbitant interest rates and then give them a worthless diploma if they even graduate, and they're saddled with a lifetime of debt. But at the same time, these CEOs, all of whom are entirely existing on federal money, are writing themselves massive paychecks. It's an extraordinary racket.
That's absolutely right. And what you've just described is a pattern of parasitic behavior. CEOs are supposed to add value to their enterprises, and their enterprises are supposed to add value to the economy. But I think what we see when we look at the CEOs of defense contractors, of private higher ed diploma mills, when we look at all these sorts of people, they're not adding any value. They're extracting value from the economy. They're extracting value from taxpayers. They're extracting value from exploited students. This is not the sort of economy that makes sense for average working Americans.
So how does this system of inflated paychecks for these CEOs who, whether they perform well or badly, it doesn't seem to matter, they still get enormous payoffs. How does that translate, for example, in terms of, you mentioned being parasitic. One of the things that I find extraordinary is that one of the richest corporations in the United States is Walmart, and
yes,
they pay their people so poorly that most of them have to, you know, rely on state and federal public assistance for food and health care, etc. So we're all where the taxpayers end up having to supplement the Walmart employees' salaries. But at the same time, as they screw their workers, they, I don't know how much they compensate their CEOs, but the family that owns most of the stock, the Walton family, the heirs, and most of whom purely as an accident of birth ended up in this position, they talk about no value added. Apparently the family combined, their combined wealth represents the equivalent of the bottom 40% of all Americans. Is that?
Yes, and here's another statistic on that. At the end of last week, Bloomberg News calculates on a weekly basis the billionaire, the wealth of the billionaires of the leading billionaires of the world. At the end of last week, four of the 12 richest people in the world were heirs to the Walton, to the Sam Walton Walmart fortune. Four of the top 12, a third of the richest dozen people in the world, owe their wealth to the Walmart empire.
And why do they need all of this money, more and more of it, at the expense of the very people who create that wealth for them, their workers?
Well, of course, there's no rational reason why they need more wealth. There's no rational reason why Larry Ellison pays himself $80-90 million every year from Oracle, the corporation he runs, when he's already one of the world's richest men. There's no rational reason. These huge paychecks, these huge fortunes, represent a power grab more than anything else. And until the power equation changes in the U.S. polity and the U.S. economy, we're going to continue to see this. But I think there's some good news here for Labor Day, and that is that a century ago, we had a situation very similar today. We had a situation where average working people were creating enormous wealth, and that wealth was being siphoned off by a precious few, by a very, very small elite in the United States. But 50 years later, in the middle of the 20th century, that plutocracy that existed at the beginning of the 20th century had essentially been smashed, and America had become the first mass middle-class nation in the history of the world. Now, and of course, in the years since then, particularly the last 30 years, that's eroded, and we have a plutocracy again. But we beat that plutocracy once. Why can't we beat it again? I think we can, and I know we must.
Well, Sam Pizzagatti, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sam Pizzagatti, who's a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's the editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and is the author of a new report released by the Institute for Policy Studies last Wednesday, the 20th Anniversary Executive Excess Report. And this has been a special broadcast of a 2013 retrospective of Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.